Pastor Mai, hello and welcome to this edition of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. How do you sell queenies across the world when prices have dropped by 40% because of a global pandemic? Shellfish supplier Island Seafair is faced with that problem as the fishing industry is undergoing a desperate period for all involved. Police on the island are asking for young people to take part in a survey on cybercrime, and the Environment Minister wants to reintroduce grey partridges on the island to shoot them. How do you sell Manx scallops in a collapsed market devastated by COVID-19 and constantly challenged by industries elsewhere? It's a problem faced by Nick Pledger, who's the managing director at Island Seafair, which operates in an office above a shellfish processing factory in Port St. Mary. The company coordinates sales of Manx produce across the world, but is feeling the effects of queenie prices dropping by almost 40% compared to last year. I asked Nick about this major problem for the industry, but first he explained where Manx shellfish goes.
Well, we operate all over the world, really. Goods are getting exported to many different markets, in particularly northern Italy, northern Spain, and also France and the UK. And we do sell a little bit locally as well in the island.
How has coronavirus affected these sales?
A huge impact. I mean, it's absolutely decimated markets. You've seen obviously sort of northern Italy in particularly was very badly hit, and Spain, of course. And then latterly we saw, you know, obviously it moved through into the UK and the island. A lot of the sales that are generated in northern Italy are especially focused on the tourism trade. I think around the Venice area, I think they have something like 25 million tourists a year. So obviously our queenies and scallops appear on the menus in many restaurants there. So without having that tourist trade, then that's been significant, and all over Spain and Italy as well. We were lucky in one sense that the customers who we operate in France is in the retail sector, so that's managed to just sort of keep the industry going, just about, I must add, you know, when everywhere else has kind of been shut down and in serious situation, really. Yeah.
How's that affecting the people who work here? I mean, I imagine you've not got as much to do at the moment.
There's always something to do. I mean, boats are continuing to fish at the moment. We've been lucky in that we haven't had a tie-up scheme, so boats have been fishing. So within the factory and the processing side, we've had to continue to handle and process product, crab, lobster, and now queenies, which is they've just started fishing them at the beginning of July. The market is so downbeat and so depressed at the moment that you know, prices are probably as much as 40% down as they were at the equivalent time last year. And so the situation, for example, with the queenies is the quota is set to the same level as last year, but obviously the income to the fishermen and the boats is significantly down. So, you know, that's having a big impact on them.
Is there anything that could change that would help both the boats and yourselves as producers?
I mean, obviously, as different regions and markets open up, then there are opportunities for more sales. As I say, I don't think people have got the income and the expenditure which they might have had before because their jobs and income levels have been impacted. So prices are you know, significantly down. I think when you're talking with the fishermen and the skippers and the boats, it would help if we could possibly increase the weekly catch limit for them, because at the moment some boats aren't fishing because it's just not cost effective for them. So if we could increase the weekly catch limits for them, which would mean that they could increase their income, then it might be more viable for them, and it would also allow the processors to function at a production level which is more beneficial to them as well. So
can you give us any figure that sort of demonstrates the difference between this year and last year, perhaps in the price of a certain product or something?
Say for example queenies, this time last year we were paying a fisherman £1.30 a kilo, now it's 70p a kilo. So if you're on the same quota and the same weekly catch limit, you know, then that's what equates to probably, I don't know, 40+% reduction in their income. Probably certain overheads are probably, you know, relatively the same. So, you know, it has a big impact on them. If the markets can't sustain the price levels that things were at this time last year.
And you must chat to fishermen, the workers here, everyone in the industry. What are people saying? Because we've heard from the Fish Producers Organisation that it's a crucial time, really, and this fishery could go either way. So what are people sort of saying?
I think the last 3 months has been incredibly challenging for the whole of the industry, fishermen and producers. And I think the next 3 months will be the same. You know, the industry is in a very difficult position at the moment. I don't know, we've just got to all kind of work together and really try to levy government, work with the fishermen, and just get all parties on board to understand the situation so we can react quickly when, you know, as and when things change.
So as a business, are you confident you'll be here in the same way next year?
You can never say that in the fishing industry. It's constantly changing all the time. We're very lucky that we have, you know, a strong customer base, which is spread over different sectors, wholesale, frozen, fresh, retail. And we also started to sell locally. We've seen a big demand local. But you always have to keep on your toes in the food industry and just keep ahead and look at what other fisheries are doing, what other areas, competing products, where are they at, how are they responding to the market, and develop your products accordingly and look to develop more branded, different ways of, you know, serving up the product.
In these difficult times, how do you set the Manx product apart from the other shellfish from around the world? Because those producers are going to be trying to compete with you guys to make sales. So how do you, in these tough times, how do you set the Manx product apart?
I mean, the island does have a great reputation for its shellfish and seafood. But what we have to do is look at the sort of unique points of difference that the Isle of Man has. One of them being is the UNESCO biosphere status what the island has, and sort of leverage that against other fisheries and products that are maybe competing on the same shelf space, and looking to develop the Isle of Man brand a lot more as well. You know, we've got fantastic events like the TT, and it's kind of like that has a huge global audience. And it's kind of tapping into a similar sort of audience with the food area as well.
And locally, we've been told by the government that a great local market has sprung up. Obviously, that doesn't go anywhere near to what you would be selling across. But is there any crumb of comfort in that?
Of course. I mean, it's encouraging because when you operate exporting most of your sales and certain markets dictating the prices, what we've seen with the COVID pandemic is obviously markets have been so downbeat that prices have been a lot cheaper than they have been for many years. Plus, there's been a real drive for buy local. So certain shellfish products have become more accessible, if you like, to the public. So when you're comparing local queenies or scallops to maybe a piece of fillet steak or something, it's quite comparable. So people are choosing to maybe look at shellfish and seafood a lot more when maybe they would have ignored it and thought it was too expensive or not quite sure what to do with it. So yeah, I think it's encouraging. We've started to sell locally as well. We chose not to do that initially, but you know, needs must and everything. It's just another sort of branch of diversification, if you like, into the business. Yeah, I think it's encouraging for the island that people, you know, they have the multiplier effect, and if people are spending more money locally, then that's got to be a good thing for the Manx economy.
Well, you mentioned the Manx economy. I wanted to ask you, I appreciate you might not have thought about this, but there's going to be a summer statement, a sort of summer budget. Would you like to see support for the fishing industry maybe come forward?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's other industries as well which are in a similar position. You know, the Isle of Man fishing industry is part of the island's heritage and its history, and it's a very important thing that we need to hang on to. The industry has received some support, like every business during the pandemic, but I think it's important that support needs to continue in the next 3-6 months and so on. What we've managed to do is keep our head above the water, but what we need to do now is just try to actually make some headway and start to make some money for everyone, really. At the moment, we're just ensuring that the industry is surviving at this point in time.
If you don't get the money, what goes? Because
there'll probably still be boats next year, but is there sort of certain infrastructure that might disappear if you can't fund it?
I mean, obviously, the first thing and the most important thing that you need to ensure doesn't go are the boats, because without that raw material and that catch being landed onto the shores, then, you know, it's impossible to keep processing. I mean, the factories, you know, they have infrastructure in place, blast freezers, cold stores. There's certain, you know, overheads that, you know, any business has that, you know, every week you open the doors and you need to achieve a certain level just to break even. So, you know, there could be other ways that support could be attained without necessarily grants or other things, but, you know, that needs looking at, and that needs sitting down and discussing that in a meeting, see what can be agreed.
Nick Pledger, the Managing Director at Island Seafair. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. Everyone's vulnerable to cybercrime, including young people, and police need their views to help get the most out of a survey on the issue. The Office of Cybersecurity is going to use the results of the survey to find out how much the Manx public know about keeping safe online, and to use that information to build future awareness campaigns. The consultation closes on the 26th of July. That's the end of this week, and is available to complete online via the government website. I spoke about the survey with Detective Inspector Gavin Callow.
Classically, people think about the email scam where you might pay someone for a service and that person's not a real person and you end up losing money. So those sort of scams, phishing scams, and there's a variety of them people are aware of. But we saw the case recently where young ladies had images that were published online. And it's important to realise that information is important to some criminals around the world, or just to people who just want to cause trouble or be nasty. And people have got to be aware of not just the money that's in your bank, but the information that you put online that can be seen by others, can be shared. And that realisation that once you put an image out there, on the web, it can be accessed by anyone, and it's out there for anyone to look at and anyone to use. So it's a massive area, and internet technology, cyber, it's intertwined into all our lives now in so many ways. Sometimes we don't actually realize it's what we do.
Do you think people think about it fully? You know, when you get bombarded with, do you accept this? Do you accept that? Can you just give your information here online? Do you think people do stop and go, what am I actually consenting to here? Or what am I at risk at? Off.
It's an interesting point. I think sometimes when you tick the terms and conditions box at the bottom of a website, you know, how many people actually read all the terms and conditions? I bet not many do. And within those, there can be the ability or the consent to use your information for a variety of purposes. And then when crimes occur, people can often get duped by criminals who are very good at what they do. They prey on vulnerabilities of people. Or people trying to keep themselves safe can be used as a tactic as well. So you think you're doing something to try and keep yourself safe because you think your account has been hacked, for example, and actually you're playing into the hands of the criminals and you're giving them information. Everyone's vulnerable in a certain way, and your vulnerability might be you don't understand the internet. Your vulnerability might be that you understand it really well and you know what to do, but someone's actually, you know, ahead of the game there and uses that to sort of con you out of your information.
How many reports do you get into the police about this type of crime?
We get several a week that we deal with, and generally they're the ones where people have actually lost money, but people are getting these emails every day. People are losing money and not reporting it to us. And I think what we're going to be doing going forward is we're looking at this survey that's going to, the results of which are going to help, you know, plan and implement the activity. And we'll be looking at what we can do to better inform the public, what advice we can give them, how we can work with the telecoms companies and the banks to improve services, improve security. Mm. So it's a massive range of things we need to do. And, you know, it's all part of a process that's ongoing every year. We had the survey last year, and this year's survey has got slightly different questions in it to try and give us a little bit more information about what people are doing.
Well, you offer advice, you know, do better passwords, go through these certain checks and stuff. I mean, I suppose that will only go so far. Do you actually succeed in catching cyber criminals and prosecuting them?
A lot of the time, the persons responsible are off Ireland. A lot of the time, they're actually outside the UK, Great Britain. So it's a difficult one sometimes. And a lot of it is about partnership working. So getting information from victims on the Isle of Man and passing that forward to agencies in the UK, and they can sometimes, you know, look at targeting websites or call centres who are impacting on the Isle of Man. But it's part of a bigger picture. People on the Isle of Man actually committing cybercrime, is that it's quite rare actually. Mm. But if we do find someone on the Isle of Man doing it, we will go after them and prosecute them if we can. But it's a worldwide problem.
Does that make it difficult? Do you just think, right, well, we can't police these things that are happening all over the world with all the risk and the anonymity and the difficulties of tracking down cyber criminals? Have you made the conscious decisions like, well, what we can do is we can help people avoid suffering from cybercrime in the first place?
Yeah, there's a few things. And again, that's a very good point. Prevention is going to be a key thing. So we say these, we say what to do, but people have to actually act on what we say or the advice we give. And then also we need to work with our partners. So we can't just ignore crime and the fact that it's happening on jurisdictions. We need to work with our partner agencies and try and tackle offenders, or be part of the team that tackles offenders is probably the best way to put it. And the public play a part in being part of that team as well, giving us the information about the scams and what's going on and what's occurred. Even if they haven't lost money on occasions, that information can be useful. It can be a piece in the puzzle to the bigger picture somewhere else in the world. So we don't want to ignore it. And, you know, we live on an Isle of Man, and the Isle of Man is a very safe place. And we say that, and it's a very safe place because of its borders, which is, you know, it's really important at the moment. We can see that. But in the cyber world, we need to make sure the borders are as strong as they can be, but also that if people are getting targeted, they know what to do. Mm. And you talked about passwords. You know, changing your passwords on a regular basis can be a bad idea, because you can tend to forget them, you can tend to write them down. So unless there has been a problem, we're advocating having three random words and some characters and capitalization is a really good way to have a strong password that's easy to remember for you, but harder for people to hack. And there's some guides we put out via the Oxia page on that, and we'll put tips and hints on there as people need them.
Is cybercrime indiscriminate when it comes to demographics? Because I know we hear that, you know, older people perhaps are more at risk of like phone scams and perhaps email scams as compared to perhaps a younger generation which are more familiar with the technology. But based on the reports you get, is it affecting everybody equally?
It affects everybody, but probably not equally. Different crimes might target different people. The Office of Cybersecurity and Information Assurance, which is where I'm working now, and they are part of the police, and we're working on this issue together. I think we found that elderly people might, you know, classically be targeted by scams because they've got money in the bank. Younger people might be targeted because they've got information. And both groups might, you know, have a lot of knowledge in certain areas and be lacking in others. But, you know, it's a variety of different tactics and a variety of different victims. So anyone can be targeted. And we do find on the Isle of Man, because, again, it's a nice place and everyone is friendly, sometimes we can be a little more likely to fall foul to it, because people are generally nice over here. You wave at people in the street, and if someone, you know, asked to borrow something off you, you know them, and you probably would. Mm. Doesn't necessarily apply on the internet. If someone contacts you, you know, they're not living next door, although they might seem like they are. They could be somewhere else, you know, in the world. So it's a difficult one, and awareness and prevention are key areas.
Who are cyber criminals? Do you guys sort of have an idea of the nature and where they might be coming from? Because as you've mentioned, that they're always looking to capitalize on the latest and change the way they're trying to trip people up and exploit people. Do you sort of know what you're looking at when you guys are sort of surveying the landscape, if you like, and sort of think, oh, we know that these guys are trying to do this and these guys are trying to do that? Or is it very much, it's quite difficult for you to keep track of what's going on out there?
Yeah, I mean, these criminals can be part of massive gang networks. Some we see some countries in the world that can allow criminal activity within their countries. And, you know, it's a variety of tactics they use, but they're criminals, it's crime. They're trying to get money and steal off people and make people's lives miserable. So it's crime. We're used to that. It's just in a different way. It's in a cyber world, in a computer environment. And sometimes we can be, you know, people can be scared of that because we don't understand computers. So that's sometimes a problem we have, that, you know, they're using some modern technology and we have to sort of keep people up to date with the latest scams and what's happening. So the COVID one, for example, where, you know, people would be wary about COVID issues and they were using that as a way to get in and sort of target people.
How much overlap is there between cybercrime and sort of cyberbullying? Because we do get reports in schools of, you know, images being exchanged or you know, issues maybe perhaps that are GDPR related as well, and it's involving young people, and young people are obviously having increasingly you know, much of their life is on the online world. How much of overlap is there between cybercrime and sort of the cyber issues that young people are facing?
I think the easiest way, and maybe it's a simplification, but I take the cyber off the front of it. So cybercrime is crime, cyberbullying is bullying. They're using the computer to make it easier and do it remotely on some instances, but it's still bullying. And if there's an offence involved, then well, we'll deal with it. So we don't want to, you know, we don't want it to seem over complex. We like to sort of simplify things and deal with it for what it is. So, you know, it's bullying, it's not acceptable. And if, you know, the school or the parents can't deal with it, we can give advice. If it goes into the criminal sort of side of things, we can deal with the offender.
So is it not complicated to distinguish clearly what is and isn't a cybercrime?
Well, we've used the term cyber enabled and cyber dependent. So some crimes you need a computer, you can't do it without it. You know, if you wanted to hold a business to ransom and lock down their systems, that clearly needs computers. Some of it is enabled, it just makes it a lot easier. So, you know, people can ring up people over the phone and try and get money out of them, but using an automated method or an email makes it a lot easier, and you can target a lot more people at once. So it just speeds up the process or gives different opportunities for people to make money out of it. The main thing we want to get across in the moment is the survey. It's important to know that it's open for all ages, and you know, we have been, the information we're seeing coming in, we're a bit underrepresented in the younger group. So if young people can fill in the survey, and if you go to www.gov.im, on the main page to the right hand side, there's a button there with the link to the survey. Take 5 minutes to fill out, and we'd really appreciate the information from people on that, and it really helps us going forward.
Detective Inspector Gavin Callow. And finally, importing grey partridges to the Isle of Man so hunters can shoot them. That's what the Environment Minister would like to see, putting forward a motion to Tynwald tomorrow. Geoffrey Boot says importation of the species will benefit other wildlife, but many dispute those claims. Bill Henderson, MLC, has written to the Chief Minister, Howard Quayle, calling for the motion to be withdrawn, calling the plans appalling. In the must-listen-to interview of last week, Lewis Foster asked Mr. Boot to justify his plans.
Most of the people that I am aware of that shoot are very keen conservationists as well, and very keen to see these birds and the biodiversity that it creates. And
but shooting surely creates a conflict of interest. If there's even the slightest bit of supposed benefit, then somebody in the shooting community might say, yes, this is worthwhile. For instance, has an independent environmental impact assessment of this proposal been carried out yet? Or is it primarily being consulted amongst hunting groups?
There's absolutely no need for an environmental impact assessment. This bird is a native bird. And I think it's a shame that some people who presumably do not like shooting as a sport, they're using everything they can as an excuse for not allowing an open season, simply an open season on a game bird, an established game bird that was harvested in the past and having had over 30 years of protection, has continued to decline in numbers. So we're reaching a point when we're talking about biodiversity and the environment and all the things that go along with that, we're facing a situation where we have the extinction of a native bird, unless people are willing to put some effort into it, invest some money and improve habitat and supplementary feed to enable the more birds to be brought
in. Does the purpose of hunting have to be behind that reintroduction? If there was such a big biodiversity benefit from introducing these birds, why can't it be done on a basis of improving wildlife?
Well, why hasn't that happened over the last 30 years? I don't see any of the conservation organisations having carried out that function. And
perhaps because they didn't feel it was actually beneficial.
Well, that is a decision they have to make. It's a sad situation, really, when we're judging shooting sports, which are legal and pursued by a great number of people, not only on the island, but throughout the UK. Conservation, the two run hand in hand.
Environment Minister Geoffrey Boot. That's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon, and you can listen again to this edition online via the Manx Radio website or through Spotify as a podcast. But for now, gurumayu and goodbye.